today, in addition to being Father's Day, is National Indigenous Peoples Day. You might have been aware. A day to celebrate and to learn more about the cultural realities and the diversity of First Nations and Inuit and Métis peoples. And in many ways, it's in the spirit of National Indigenous Peoples Day that I want to explore our talky bit topic this morning. And perhaps as good a jumping off place as any is our shared land acknowledgement. We gather on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, the Cree, the Oji-Cree, the Dakota, and the Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We respect the treaties that were made on these territories. We acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past, and we dedicate ourselves to move forward in partnership with Indigenous communities in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. You might be familiar with the name Phelan Johnson. Phelan is Mohawk Tuscarora Bear Clan from Six Nations Grand River Territory. She is a writer, probably best known as a playwright, but a writer and also the co-host of CBC podcast, The Secret Life of Canada. And Phelan, writing about land acknowledgements, says this: "When I think about the practice of land acknowledgements, there's something I try and hold on to. If it doesn't feel like work, then you're probably not doing it right." Yes. Acknowledgement, she says, is an active thing. You need to be situated in that acknowledgement or its lip service. If people don't know what they're doing or why they're doing it, then my suggestion is don't do it. Interesting, hey? Acknowledgement is an active thing. You need to be situated in that acknowledgement or its lip service. That's interesting. And then in a separate piece, Johnson writes about her personal recurring experience of being renovicted, not a word that I'd heard before I read this, but a word that kind of makes sense, evicted under the guise of renovation. She writes about her experience of being renovicted in Toronto, which is where she lives, and the connection between that experience and land acknowledgements. So this is how she says that. She writes, "I'm Mohawk and Tuscarora, and a few hundred years ago, my people traded, farmed, hunted on this land. Toronto comes from an Iroquoian word, Tukaranto. So every time I'm at an event with a land acknowledgement, as I hear the name of my people, the Haudenosaunee, spoken with great reverence and honor, I think to myself, sure, but how long can I afford to be acknowledged in my own land? How long before I am renovicted off my own damn land? Sometimes in my head, I finish the acknowledgement so it reads, quote, we'd like to acknowledge the Haudenosaunee for as long as they can afford it here, close quote. Ever wonder what our land acknowledgement feels like to someone from the peoples that are being acknowledged? This is not the take on it, but it is a take on it. And we need to pay attention to those things. It's complicated. And situating ourselves inside something like an acknowledgement of a problem is complicated and challenging. Acknowledgement is an active thing. It needs context. And for me today, that context has a couple of facets. The first facet of the context today for me is this ongoing biological pandemic and our tenuous initial movements toward re-engaging. Some of the things that we shut down, you know, I mean, we shut down, we slowed down things in order to slow the spread of this new and contagious illness. And now as we re-engage with some of those things, that can feel like it really contributes to our sense of uncertainty. And the second facet is what I've heard a few different folks recently called the pandemic of racism. Now, I could imagine someone hearing that phrase, the pandemic of racism, being used these days and feeling like that was a bit opportunistic, like that was someone taking advantage of the suffering of others to further their own agenda. I can't recall where I heard it first, and so I don't have anyone particular in mind when I quote it, and that helps me to steer clear of the motivation or judging the motivation of whoever might have coined the phrase, which I think is just as well, because it seems to me I truly doubt that I'd be qualified to judge that motivation, even if it was my place to do so. But again, context matters. And in particular, in this case, what I mean by that is that COVID is a pandemic, but it is not the pandemic. And that's not just fiddling around with words. It's easy to lose sight of the fact that despite the novel nature of this virus and its subsequent disease, pandemics are not novel, and they can be comprised of anything that, by definition, occurs over a wide geographic area and affects an exceptionally high proportion of the population. That's the definition of a pandemic. So, for example, Martin Filler, writing in the New York Review of Books, talks about globalization this way. He writes, writing of globalization, he says, globalization is the most thoroughgoing socioeconomic upheaval since the Industrial Revolution, which has set off a pandemic of retrogressive nationalism, regional separatism, and religious extremism. So that's an example of the word pandemic being used according to one of its most common and longstanding definitions. From that angle, I think it's relatively easy to see that racism, which occurs over a wide geographic area and affects an exceptionally high proportion of the population, is also a pandemic. And that is an essential aspect of a land acknowledgement. It's another way of naming a particular outbreak of an ongoing pandemic, the pandemic of racism, that has not generated anything like the required global or local response necessary to keep the people exposed to it safe. It's interesting to move the metaphor around, isn't it? So here's a question. This is my question. You might not share it, but I think it'll have some resonance. What can we do to situate ourselves inside a pandemic so that we're not just paying lip service to it or responding to it out of some sort of sense of having no choice, out of a victim mentality or out of the potentially useless weight of white guilt, but rather out of a sense of deep and personal engagement? What can we do to situate ourselves that way? One of the things that makes it challenging for me to answer a question like that well is the relatively insulated nature of my privileged life. I don't often have the experience of interdependence as essential. Many of the ideas I'm going to explore in this talky bit have their roots in African communities, which is a deliberate choice this morning on my part. These are communities that have their own experiences with both health pandemics and racial pandemics, and their own lived experience with those two pandemics coming at the same time. And so I'm looking to them for wisdom unique to that. I am not well situated to speak with the lived wisdom of people with that sort of history, but I can take the time to show up. I can take the time to listen. And in my own context, I can also stand up by sharing their wisdom. Those are all directives. Show up, listen up, stand up. Those are all the kinds of themes that I keep finding when I'm looking for an answer to the what can I do sorts of questions. So, to explore these things in the context of this community is one way, and it's only one way, it's not the way, but it's one way that I can stand up and that I can work to situate myself in whatever it is that I'm trying to acknowledge. I hope that idea will expand as we go. I'm going to primarily work with the pandemic idea this morning as representing a physical disease. But my hope is that we can understand from the beginning that racism in all its forms is no less of a pandemic, no less a cause of cultural destruction, of economic hardship, and of death, no less a reason for broad, concerted action than a novel virus is. I was on a downtown sidewalk last week, and a person I've never seen before decided that would be the perfect time to share their own experience and their own perspective on the COVID pandemic with me. I was already in motion, and it wasn't slow motion. I was running errands, and I was zoom, and I was tearing down the sidewalk, and they just stepped into this uninvited lockstep beside me and started in with a vigorous and passionate declamation of all things related to distancing and isolating and businesses being closed. The government, in their opinion, had gone way too far. This whole thing was a joke, a farce, etc. And then I got to my car. I smiled at them. I didn't say anything. They didn't really seem to be looking for dialogue. And I got into my car, and they and their rant carried on down the sidewalk, and I closed the door and I used some hand sanitizer. I don't really know anything about this person. Their appearance suggested they might be more vulnerable to any sort of changing circumstances than I am, but I have no way of really knowing that. What I do know is that when I was sitting in the bubble of my car, washing my hands, the question it raised was, who am I doing this for? Am I disinfecting my hands because I'm concerned about my health and safety? Am I doing this because I don't want to carry something potentially problematic home to my family? Any chance what I'm doing here has a connection to the sidewalk prophet that I was just with? Prophets, by the way, lots of them got it wrong. In terms of history, it's not the accuracy of prediction that characterizes a prophetic voice as much as it is the passionate proclamation that something is not as it should be, which this person had down. Is there any chance that I'm cleaning my hands because it's a way of caring for that slightly wild-eyed person that was just talking to me? Who am I doing this for anyway? Personally, I find the ideas of kin or siblings helpful when I'm wrestling with questions like this. Who are my siblings? Who's my family? And in what sort of ways might I imagine or engage with my responsibilities for them? These are, of course, these are not new questions. Even in the context of the ancient stories that many of us in this community have grown up with, these kinds of questions are high on the human agenda when it comes to trying to imagine how we might possibly make good worlds of the earth. A story that comes to mind is the Genesis 4 story, the story of Cain and Abel. Now, that whole story, like all the stories in that ancient compilation, takes place in this curious mythological world in which animals talk and there are no daughters but only sons, and yet there are still wives to be found and mothers to be found. There's only one family, and yet there are somehow several tribes. And there are other things that are just not explained, but that reflect a confounding world and the experience of a confounding world in which much more can be seen and experienced than can be understood. And so the wrestling out loud to say, how shall we frame these experiences? How shall we seek meaning in them is a central task in all of that story making. And I'm not going to recap the Cain and Abel story in any detail, but the very short version of it is that Cain kills his brother Abel. And he does it because they're different from one another. He does it because they are culturally different, a curious thing that we often easy to miss. If we've been taught to read this story as though it were literal history, we wouldn't tend to think about brothers as culturally different. But if you actually read the content of the story, they're very different. This is the steak eater and the vegan running into one another at a How Shall We Save the Earth event. They're very culturally different. They are religiously different. They are even economically different. And those differences make Cain so uncomfortable that he resorts to violence to so-called, solve the problem. And to eradicate the reminder in his lived experience every day of those differences, he kills his brother. And the God character in the story, who sometimes seems to choose to function sort of like a contemporary therapist. The God character asks these questions with the design, it seems, that perhaps if the other party considers their own answer, they might see things for themselves. And so sort of in that tone, the God character in the story asks Cain, "Where is your brother?" And Cain says, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? In my imagination," and this is an important part of reading stories, "in my imagination," Cain's tone there is always seems to be a bit perpetually adolescent. "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Yeah. Let's just take the God character's question and carry it into our contemporary setting a little bit, at least linguistically. And let's bring it home. Where are my siblings? That is not, as we could see in another famous Jesus story where someone tries to dodge a thorny question by asking, "Who's my neighbor?" This is not a locational question. This is a relational question. Do I have any actual idea what my siblings, what my fellow human beings are up to, what their life is like, what they are facing today? Am I their keeper? Who am I doing this for anyway? How I answer those kinds of questions depends in no small part on whether or not I view myself as vitally connected to, even interdependent with, my fellow human beings, or as a relatively isolated instance of human, someone whose actions happen in some padded sphere that renders them irrelevant to the other surrounding spheres. And maybe the deeper wisdom about this is carried better by those whose life circumstances make the reality of human interdependence more visible, more visceral, more real. That suspicion is what carried me toward the wisdom of African communities on this. There's an African proverb that says, "When one finger touches oil, it soon soils the others." When one finger touches oil, it soon soils the others. That's a way of saying we're all connected, and what one of us does impacts all of us. And that's not just true of the damaging things we do. It's also true of the healing things, of the caring things that we do. And as is often the case with Proverbs, you'll notice this if you've spent any time in the Proverbs collection that's part of the Bible. As is often the case with Proverbs, this one has a companion proverb that sort of comes from the other side. Sort of there's this negative commentary and there's a positive commentary. And the positive African proverb that's like the bookend to that one says, "When one hand washes the other, both hands are clean." When one hand washes the other, both hands are clean. Oh, and we know all about washing our hands, don't we? Yeah. Sometimes proverbs are just so, they make concrete something that we would be far more comfortable keeping abstract, eh? We could say that proverbs like these are pointing us toward both the necessity and the power of ideas like solidarity or compassion or the common good and the actions arising from those ideas. So, to unpack that just a little bit, solidarity, for instance, can help us move beyond duty. And that's always important, but right now we're living with circumstances that make the power of it, I think, abundantly clear. That language, the appeal to duty, that was some of the prevalent early language of the lockdown. "Do your civic duty" was the phrase of the day for quite some time, at least here in Manitoba, and it was often used in conjunction with the language of war, of battling a pandemic. And that's familiar terrain, of course, when it comes to the history of how to motivate a populace to do something that they don't intuitively want to do or that might unsettle them. I am not trying to denigrate the importance of citizenship or duty in this illustration. As with obligation, it's not a categorically problematic idea. It's a complicated idea, though, because And we should handle it with some caution because it opens into questions about things like duty to whom and why. And those are important questions when we're going to live collectively in any situation. It can also open into ideas like the relationship between self-care and solidarity, which is an interesting relationship. And this is important because it can help us understand necessary actions in a more full-orbed way. So, for example, washing my hands or wearing a mask, those can be ways of doing something bigger than me. Now, I might be doing them just because I've been told to do them, but, and that's personal. I mean, some of us would do them because we were told to, others of us because they resonate for us, others of us because we're afraid personally, and so on and so forth, across the whole gamut of responses. But even if I'm doing those things because I've been told to, doing them isn't just taking care of me. It's taking care of those in proximity to me and those in proximity to them and those in proximity to them and so on and so on and so on in these rippling circles that go out from that choice. When I wash my hands as a way of practicing self-care, I am doing a good thing. When I wash my hands as an act of solidarity, as an act of other care, I'm nudging my way out of my bubble and into a worldview that potentially locates me in both struggles and joys that are greater than me and mine. When I wash my hands as an act of solidarity, I am doing a better thing. To use language for this that we've considered in more depth here before, self-care practiced in this way can also move me toward compassion. And compassion, of course, is suffering with, suffering together, choosing not to remain indifferent to the suffering of others. To put it into the language of yet another African proverb, unquestionably my favorite of the collection I'm working from this morning, a chicken develops a headache when it sees another chicken in the cooking pot. Yeah, I suppose. Oh man, that's kind of humorous. Might even sound trite, unless you're a chicken. Or if we're not even used to seeing a chicken in a cooking pot. But the beauty of proverbs is that they can be contextualized. They can locate us in a story that isn't directly ours. So let's try this. A human finds it hard to breathe when it sees another human suffocated by oppression. A human finds it hard to breathe when it sees another human suffocated by oppression. In the Genesis story, the question, "Where is your brother?" can fairly be read as a rhetorical setup. It's the storyteller's way of zooming the camera out so we can see what the Cain character is in denial about. And perhaps if we attend to the story with our imagination engaged, we can hear the voice of the all-seeing storyteller saying, "I know where your sibling is. And so do you." The real question is, do you want to own up to what you know or not? Either way, it's going to come out. The spilled blood of the past has something to say, and if the humans don't say it, the earth will. So, go ahead. Own it. You're not doing it for you anyway. Peace, everybody. We'll chat next week. Bye for now.